Intangibility is much more interesting, but it's also really scary. It's sort of like having a girlfriend who's into mushrooms and Bitcoin, because now every conversation is infinity. Welcome to an all new episode of the McFuture podcast. I'm Steve Factor, and today we're going to talk about conquest. That's right, conquering the world of weak allies. In the first episode of this mini-series on the McFuture, I talked about how weak bonds are creating weak friendships. In the second episode, I talked about how weak alliances are replacing weak friendships because just by comparison, their bonds are stronger. Well, today I want to talk about a formula that I put together for conquering this new world, and it's related to reciprocity. But let's start off with the basics. We think of people who chase material wealth and power as selfish, and maybe narcissists who sacrifice kittens in the back of a pizzeria with Hillary Clinton and the lizard people, whatever your conspiracy du jour might be. And we think of altruists as these wonderful people, Mother Teresa washing poor people's feet. I don't know why Mother Teresa is the only altruist that comes to mind, and she's been dead for like at least a decade. There must be someone else out there who's like super famous and super giving. I don't know who that is, but he or she is probably out breastfeeding the poor or pigeons or something. The reality is, in life, there are very few unconditional givers, especially in positions of power and influence. And you see this with all of these activists and activist organizations that outlive their purpose or even outlive the solution that they're trying to push because it hasn't been successful. So what do? They start to exaggerate their problems and expand their scope, or they conjure new enemies and they start to fight for survival. They're fighting for resources and mind share and relevance. And when survival of the organization trumps the cause, that's selfishness. Climate change is a perfect example of this. So they asked people, you know, do you support climate change? This was a Washington Post survey. And they're like, we do. We love helping solve climate change. And then they asked them, well, which of these taxes would you support? And they supported none of them. They wanted none of the things that cost them money to solve this thing that they think is an issue. They're going to need personal ROI in order to do this, or see the blunt edge of a musket, which is how I envision all future wars will be fought. What's really interesting is that the selfish and the supposedly selfless need each other. They're symbiotic. You can't have charity without innovation and growth to provide the capital to give to charity. Altruists need sugar daddies, and the sugar daddies need absolution. They need forgiveness for their sins, but they also need tax write-offs. And so you have this symbiotic relationship between the two. Both are equally ambitious in their own ways and equally selfish. What selfishness also does is it makes every exchange transactional. Both parties have to believe that there's some benefit in it for them in order to do something, whatever that something is. And that's obvious in business and shopping and travel. Those transactions are tangible. They're really easy to understand. As we start moving towards weaker alliances and more virtual lives, tangible transactions are becoming less important, and the intangible ones become the core of reciprocity. Reciprocity is getting harder because weak allies aren't the only thing that's proliferating. For example, humans are really capable of only managing 150 relationships. We've shot way, way past that already. And each one of these flimsy relationships on Facebook or Instagram or LinkedIn, wherever it is that they exist, each one is a threat. It's a threat to steal time and energy and resources away from your life and from maybe other meaningful, more meaningful relationships that you have. This must be how Jesse James felt everywhere he'd go, any one of these musty strangers could be a bounty hunter. Well, our bounty is time, and we don't have any more of it today than we did when we dueled at high noon, because there's still the same number of hours and still the same number of days in the week. And then there's this blur of information that's coming at us. You've got rapes in India, forced labor camps in China, and the missing van girl. All of these things are important and sometimes tragic to the people affected, but they're utterly irrelevant to us. Our biology isn't meant to handle it. We can't handle the digital equivalent of having Superman's hearing, where every global struggle is laid bare before us, and none of Superman's power to do anything about it. And that makes us feel powerless and depressed. And then there's the social networks like Instagram. We're constantly looking at people whose lives are spectacular, at least that's their best day. And it's making us miserable and making us feel powerless to attain some of these things. We should know 98% of it, maybe more. It amounts to voyeurism and entertainment. And it's burning out our capacity to care. But reciprocity demands care. How do you get someone to care about your issue, your problem, when they're under siege by everyone else's? When everything is surplus? When everything is disposable? So are we. So what happens when our senses are under siege? Everybody becomes a psychiatrist or psychologist or sociologist because we're always on the hunt to get people or convince people, allies, to come to our side, to focus on what's important to us. So now we're in mind game territory. And most of the people we want things from are more powerful and desirable than ourselves. Could be an executive or a politician or a celebrity, people we might not even know or not know very well, and motivating them is really hard. Or it could be a colleague or a boss, and their contribution could be the difference between a cubicle and a more luxurious cubicle. Maybe even one of those fishbowl offices where people can walk by and knock on the glass. And you can look back at them and open your eyes and your mouth like a fish. And often it seems that we don't have a lot to offer those people. Maybe in a work environment, there's something formalized. But for the most part, we're on our own. Well, lucky for you, I came up with a formula to motivate people to do what you want them to do. This is still a work in progress, but I think it'll be a good start. I call it the four A's of reciprocity. So the first step is analyze. The goal here is to understand what people want and what motivates them and match it to what you want. And in that overlap is where the magic is going to happen. And clues to understanding what people value are everywhere. You know, you go into somebody's office, for example, you immediately know what their hobbies are because they've got pictures of their kids or them going skiing or them doing some sort of trekking or whatever. Most people have some sort of personal flair. So your job in that office, as much as it is to have the meeting or the interview or whatever reason you're there, but it's also to break down and understand what exactly drives this person. You could even get a sense of someone's priorities and values based on their Twitter profile. You can see, did they write husband or mother first before they wrote CEO or head of whatever? You can see, based on that prioritization, what drives them. Are they completely career-driven or are they family-driven? So everything is a clue. And same thing with their personality or identity. How seriously do they take themselves? Most people of any kind of prominence have stuff out there, interviews that they've done on YouTube, on podcasts. Do they have a sense of humor? Do they take themselves really seriously? Are they self-deprecating? Are they super detail-oriented and get into the weeds? Or are they big picture? Are they braggadocious and have a big ego? These are all things you can tell, and this is all homework you can do that will help you get to that next stage to get them to be an ally in your cause. And just even basic extroversion or introversion. Do they have a bunch of social media accounts? Are they on every platform? You know, do they seek that attention? And do they write the posts themselves, or is it some PR person trying to position and make them look a certain way? These are all clues, and they're all out there. Everyone has some degree of publicity these days, to our detriment, but still, it's out there. And basically, this is the same homework all of our future employers will be doing on us anyway. We should be doing it too. We should be building a profile. I mean, nothing creepy, like, you know, don't follow people around and don't get one of those cork boards that the serial killers get with all the newspaper clippings with the lines drawn and the big red X's. Yeah, don't do that. And don't start a fan club, because those don't always work out. But other than that, yeah, we should be profiling just like others profile us. And the second part of the analysis is introspection. What do we want? And the more specific our ask, the more focused it is, the easier it'll be to zoom in on what it is that will motivate that person to do that thing. And how big is your ask? Are you asking for $10,000 cash? Are you asking for a job? Are you asking for a recommendation? What is that ask? And that'll give you a sense of proportionality. Like, what do I have to do, or what level do I have to be at to even have a chance of offering enough value in return? And at that overlap between your profile of that person and your profile of yourself and your own needs is where magic happens. And that's where the next step kicks in. The next step is assimilation. This is where you inhabit the style, the language, the mentality, the values, the expertise, the interests of this other person. And again, that sounds super creepy. I think there was a movie called Bound where a girl literally did that to her roommate, and eventually was there a murder? I think there was a murder. At the very least, a pet died. So if I was a writer, which I am, but if I wanted to get the attention of someone like Elon Musk, I might start blogging about space or intellectual pursuits or general curiosities, things that appeal to someone like Elon. Well, that's exactly what happened to Tim Urban, who was the creator of a very popular blog called Wait But Why. He wrote these long pieces about, you know, how the mind works and just different curiosities, things like, you know, procrastination and the procrastination monkey and all this stuff. Really interesting. He has a really good, vibrant style. And it caught the attention of Elon Musk. So eventually, Elon reached out to him and gave him a series of exclusive interviews that Tim ended up writing up about space and the future and all these things. Even though he didn't set out to meet Elon necessarily, I don't think he did. The reason this worked is he inhabited a space that eventually would also find Elon in it. And the same thing goes for any industry. Every industry has its buzzwords, has its way of doing business, has its PowerPoint style. Or in the case of Amazon, Jeff Bezos hates PowerPoint. So he would do like these 2-pagers or 10-pagers for any new projects or product. So knowing that is a great way to start connecting the dots and connecting to those people. This was very common in the startup space. I remember when I was really into it and I was working corporate and we would partner with startups. Even now, I talk to a lot of these entrepreneurs. They're constantly going to events, and the events attract a lot of wantrepreneurs, but some of those ended up becoming entrepreneurs because they started to understand the space and rub elbows with people who spoke the language. They understood what the VCs were looking for. So they were in this assimilation phase to absorb what this world was like. And you have to do that regardless of the world. If you're writing screenplays, if you're in the music business or want to be a music manager, whatever it is that you want to do, you have to start assimilating that knowledge and that language. And the goal of all of this is to be able to frame our needs in terms of their interests. In other words, what I need will help you as much as it helps me. It's sort of the Tom Sawyer idea where Tom convinced all his friends to paint his fence because he pretended, oh, look how much fun it is. Look how amazing it is. And eventually they got so jealous. They're like, oh man, look at how much fun Tom is having. We better go convince him to paint his fence. Now, most people aren't this malleable. So the way you convince people has to be more subtle. Although if after seeing this, you get a CEO to paint your fence, you better contact me and tell me that story and I'm going to use it on the podcast. The third A of reciprocity is a credit, not a credit, but a credit or accreditation. Oh man, that's a big word. Whenever you graduate college, hopefully it's an accredited institution and you're getting accredited by proxy. Same thing when you're an academic and your study gets peer reviewed and published, then that is a form of accreditation. Same thing with getting a promotion. Now you get to put another title on your resume. In fact, every single one of these things, once you achieve that milestone, a magical bullet appears on your resume that shows people that you have reached a milestone. And today more than ever, informal accreditation is becoming more powerful than the formal type. You can become a top earning YouTuber or podcaster or musician or entrepreneur just by mastering all of these tools for distribution and creation that are available to us. Things that, you know, required all of these gatekeepers and institutions to access. If you wanted to produce movies, man, you would need access to a studio where you could cut tape and you needed these expensive cameras. Now you can do all that on an iPhone. And so you can self-accredit in ways that you couldn't even explain to grandma. I bet you most YouTubers can't even explain what they do to their parents. They're like, yeah, I walk around and I film myself. And they're like, well, doing what? Too many questions. But self-accreditation takes time, sometimes years of thankless toil. And believe me, I know. I've been doing this podcast for a while. It's hard. And the payoffs are uncertain, to say the least. And if you are successful at building an audience or an impressive body of work or a great app, that builds awareness. That also builds a form of indirect leverage that you could use. And eventually, if you persevere, and that's really important, just sticking to it, eventually prospective allies will find you because you've created something really from thin air. And people who are successful are attracted to that. In a Econovation, I wrote about how the future is auditioning, which is basically doing the job before the job even exists. Here's a clip from a keynote I did. I think it was either 2010 or 2011. I don't know. Check it out.
Young people who are tech savvy, they're not going to be sending out resumes anymore, and you shouldn't expect them to. One way that they're going to find jobs in the future is by doing the job first. And one thing that happened, Google Instant, which I don't know if you're familiar with, that's when you start typing into Google and all of your search results automatically changed. Well, a Stanford student basically the next day created the same thing for YouTube on his own. And you know what happened that same day? He got a tweet from the CEO of YouTube offering him a job, telling him to quit school. So this is the new type of recruitment. It's auditioning, and it's a far more fulfilling, accelerated path.
And same goes for Tim Urban from Wait But Why. He created a body of work. He didn't do it all in one blog post. By the time his work made it over to Elon, Elon could click around and see, oh man, this is someone I'm interested in. I like the way this person thinks. And so there's depth there that wouldn't have existed if Tim didn't put in the work. So Tim was accredited in ways that Elon respected. And chances are other people that Elon respected were forwarding some of these posts to him, which is also a form of accreditation. And relationships really are the best form of accreditation. Obviously, it's great when you could do it directly and work for somebody or show them directly what you can do. But it's almost as good if someone they respect does it on your behalf. So that warm introduction will cut through months or years in some cases of having to prove yourself. And a lot of it is a byproduct of work you've done that is unpaid, unglorious, and has no feedback loop. You know, you do a lot of these shows and podcasts and you don't hear from people until maybe you bump into them and they're like, oh, I love your show. But if they're not online and then they're not always sharing, all of a sudden it's like, hey, you know, how would I know? Little sidebar, if you know someone who is doing things that you like and puts them out there, let them know. It's fuel to keep them going because it'll get them to that point of accreditation for whatever it is that they're trying to accomplish. And there's a fair amount of self-interest in that, but I mean it sincerely. The fourth A is where all the action happens. The fourth A is activate. This is where all of your analysis and assimilation and accreditation, this is where they bear fruit. So this is the tactical manifestation of reciprocity. Oh my God, there's so many syllables in that sentence. Please, Lord, forgive me, for I've sinned. Once you're at this step, you should be an object of desire in some capacity. What's amazing about entering this phase is one win, one ally can create a snowball effect because it opens all of these doors. There's such a thing as personal momentum, and maybe in a future episode I'll go deeper into it, but people are attracted to things that they perceive are successful. And they will feel more confident in sharing it when that perception exists. So these things start to mount up. And that's why all of these people who are online salesmen, in fact, I think it was Tony Robbins started out this way where they were just hawking different like education products or real estate products. And one of the ways in which they validated themselves and created personal momentum is by showing pictures of themselves with celebrities. Now, you don't know if they ran into them, you know, in the supermarket or, you know, snuck up on them and took a photo, whatever it is. But once you see that, you start to believe that person's got something going on. And when you think someone's got something going on, you want to be near them. And so you create gravity towards yourself with these wins. And if you use this gravity the right way, you're going to attract the right kinds of allies. And you also need a filter for the wrong kinds. Activation exchanges can be tangible or intangible, but they could also be positive or negative. And let me break down what these are. Tangible exchanges are the easiest to understand. And, you know, they could be positive or negative. Let's say you want Seth Godin to speak at your conference. Well, pay Seth Godin and he will speak at your conference. It's simple enough. Any kind of exchange of money, goods, services, property, those are tangible things. And, you know, if you want to give Seth your house, he'll take it. Now, if you've got some weird, kinky conference, well, maybe Seth doesn't want to do it, but you ask him anyway, and maybe he will show up in the leather duck outfit. I'm kidding. Seth would never do that because, you know, leather is murder. He might go for the duck outfit. I don't know. You could even develop a really good working relationship with Seth, but it's still commerce. It's still an exchange of tangible goods. In fact, most work-related things are tangible exchanges. So if you're an employee or something and you're negotiating, yeah, you can get benefits and perks and, you know, there's salary, there's maybe geography and moving bonuses and all this stuff, but it's still, at the end of the day, it's still money, it's still value, tangible value being exchanged. I had a situation where I was thinking about, hey, maybe I'll get into comedy. And this was, you know, a few years ago. And I saw a comedian in a club who used to be a musician and decided to become a comedian later in life. And he's experiencing a lot of success. So I reached out to him and said, hey, you know, would love to take you out for, you know, for dinner or something to just, you know, have a conversation. And in our exchanges back and forth, he made it pretty clear to me that he expected to be paid. And I get it because this is a guy who doesn't know me, doesn't owe me anything. And there's really not a lot that I was offering him at the time. But knowing what I know now and what we're exploring in this episode, I'm pretty sure I'd be able to motivate him without cash and purely with intangibles. And that's really the point. As our physical needs get met, everything becomes about intangibles. And intangibles are far more interesting, but they're also infinite. It's sort of like having a girlfriend who's into mushrooms and Bitcoin, because now every conversation is infinity. Digital is infinity, and whatever hallucinations you're having are infinity. And that's what the intangible world is like. So let's talk about positive intangibles. And let me define positive for a second. Positive is not necessarily positive for society, but positive for the individual and also for their prospective ally. For example, acceptance. Acceptance is positive in theory, unless it's to the Aryan Brotherhood, and then it's bad for society. Just know that I'm talking about the individualized version and not the societal version. So positive intangibles include things like access to an audience, because now you've built up an audience in this accreditation phase. You're able to offer that trust that you've built with them to somebody else. That's one of the reasons I've been able to attract all these great guests to the show. Everyone from Nadine Strossen to Jim Jeffries to Nobel economist Joseph Stiglitz to Jesse Ventura, the former governor, and the late Larry King. I was able to build a following of over 800,000 people on social media, on LinkedIn and my email newsletter and all these places. So now, in their eyes, I'm accredited and I'm giving them access to this audience, which is appealing. All that stuff is not easy. I had to write a book. And honestly, if I did the math on all the time I put into writing books and articles and all this other stuff, and then divided how much I made from those things by the hours spent, I would have been better off in McDonald's, or I would have been better off killing someone from McDonald's and then scamming my way into the insurance money, or selling cigarettes in prison. I'm not sure. But the idea is that you don't know. You don't know what is going to pay off, but it did. Another positive intangible is common causes or affiliations. You could be into wellness or gaming or the environment, or maybe you went to the same university and maybe they've donated to that university, so they have a strong affiliation. All of these things are ways of building and reinforcing a sense of belonging and community. That could be an interesting way of channeling all of these things you've built in these other steps. A good example of that is Dave Portnoy, who's the founder and CEO of Barstool Sports. He's a self-made success. There's no doubt about it. Dave now has a podcast with literally a child. I think he's 17 or 18. He's a TikTok star named Josh Richards. Dave has nothing in common with Josh, from what I could tell. But Dave also knows that it's really important for him to reach this next generation and the Gen Z audience. So there's something in it for him. And Josh also would like the validation of this accomplished guy. So there's this mutual benefit exchange between the two of them. Now, depending on the ally that you're targeting, asking for advice can be a very powerful intangible, because people want to feel validated, especially ones that are ready to share. Now, if they're in demand, it might be too much of an ask, so you have to make a really killer case for why you deserve it. And one of the things that helps convince people is that you've done the work. Successful people want to help those who help themselves. They're not going to drag you 100% of the way. No one will. And that's always been my attitude. Like, if you come to me completely empty-handed, you haven't done the work, and come to think of it, if I'm really honest with myself, when I approached that comedian, I hadn't done the work, so I didn't deserve to meet him. But if I did approach him now, I probably would have done more, and then I think I would have had a much better chance. Also, depending on what stage he's in and if he's ready to give. And in fact, you know, I did a segment about mentorship. Mentoring is kind of next level because it's a big ask and people aren't necessarily prone to committing to something like that, to a stranger. So here's a clip I'll include here that I did in a previous episode about what makes for a good or a bad mentor. And a guy online, he asked me, can a stranger become a mentor if you happen to be one of those young climbers? It's very rare. People who are desirable mentors they have a long line of people in their immediate circle who want to be mentored by them. Those people are going to get first dibs. And that also improves their network. Like if you're mentoring a kid of a friend, you do mentor because you have something to offer and you have that itch to scratch, right? You want to feel wanted. You want to feel like all that wisdom that you've accumulated isn't going to waste. But it's just as fulfilling, probably more fulfilling, to mentor someone who is in your social or professional circle than someone who's a complete stranger. Now, there is that one way, which is the climber who volunteers to do something for that person. But I don't think that's a good idea. And here's why. Someone who gets value from you is compromised. That's a person who has a vested interest in the choices that you make. That's why a boss can't be a mentor, because they have a vested interest in what you choose or your performance. It has to be someone who just has your best interest at heart. And that's very hard to find. The other part of it is there's a life stage issue here. Not everyone is ready to be a mentor. If you're still climbing yourself and you're still trying to conquer the world or build a business or become a great artist, it doesn't matter what category. At that stage, you're still a taker. You're taking things from the world. You're taking labor. You're taking energy. You're taking things because you're still building. You need fuel to keep building. The only kind of person, from my experience, is a person who has reached a certain level where they're confident enough and they're not as hungry. They may still be competitive, but there has to be something where they've reached a comfortable place and they're in a position to give, because takers are not good givers. Probably the most powerful intangible is validation. People want their work, their efforts to be validated. They want to know that other people care, especially if they're putting out books and podcasts and all this, public information. They want to know that others care about their ideas, that labor was not for nothing. Their status, their identity, everything is wrapped up into this work or these ideas. So when you position yourself to that person and make an appeal, it has to appeal to how they see themselves and the value that they've offered the world, and that you see that value and truly understand it. You thought only millennials could be non-binary? Well, so can intangibles. There are some things that vacillate between positive and negative. For example, urgency. Very few things in life are truly urgent. You've had entire empires built on falsifying urgency. There's a company called Gilt, which is still around, but it was valued at billions of dollars. And all it did was create flash sales of things that were kind of scarce, but not really, because at some point they had the manufacturers create products specifically for them. So it wasn't really scarce, but it gave you the impression because, hey, there's this ticking clock and this special is going to run out in 4 hours. Limited time offers is just one of those things that can take something that's abundant and make it seem like it's in short supply and you better act now. There's a corporate term for this too, called burning platform. And it came up all the time in corporate meetings. A good example of it is, hey, competitor X is doing Y, so we better do Z. So it was a way of getting executives to move on things or give you budget to try certain things. So it's a trick that, quite honestly, is a grenade that could very easily explode in your hands. So you got to be very careful with it, because it's very hard to create urgency for things that aren't truly urgent. But it's also a trick that can work sometimes. And certainly Gilt proved that to be the case. Another intangible that can go both ways is righteousness. Now, you could be right, but not righteous, or you could be wrong and righteous. So there is a button in people, and we've certainly discovered this over the last few years or whatever, 5-6 years, that if you press this button, people would love to lord how right they are over you. That is a button you can press at any time and trigger something. It's very dogmatic. It's very much like religion. And when you press that button, you can get people to do a lot of things, especially if they're on your side and they share the same cause. You just hit them in the religion where it hurts, and they will come to you because now you're this ally who shares their cause, and together you can crap on people who aren't, who don't share that cause. So it is powerful. It can also be dark, especially on social media where people pile on with each other. But it's a tool in that intangible toolbox. Another intangible that can go both ways is relationships. You can have a relationship with a person your targeted ally respects, and it opens a door. That's great. That's super positive. Or you could be a name dropper to get you through the door somewhere. And if your relationship isn't that close, eventually gets back to that other person and you end up destroying both relationships, the one that you lied yourself into and the one with the other person that probably wasn't as strong as you thought it was or made it out to be. The other way to ruin it is having too big an ask. So yeah, you can be friends with somebody or you might have worked with them and they have a good relationship with you. But if you ask too much of this other person, it's an imposition. So it's always a fine line how to deploy this without ruining both sides of the equation. And casual name dropping just in general has a very short lifespan. It mostly works on Entourage, where you get into the club and then there is no after. You know, maybe you pick up a girl in the club. Let's talk about negative intangibles. These are things that are also tools in your toolbox that could get dark quickly. One of the more innocuous ones is beauty. I've been in rooms with people whose names you would know, famous, accomplished, a lot of them middle-aged men. And I've seen rooms stop for some 25-year-old in a really tight dress and accentuated assets. Let's put it that way. They were putty in her hands. And these are people with real accomplishments for someone who didn't have much of anything going on. But if deployed too often, it creates a level of resentment, and also it creates sort of a ceiling at some point, because deploying beauty too often eventually gets others to resent you, whether it's other women who are also competing for attention or jobs or whatever environment this is in. The people who work for these people can get resentful because you're giving disproportionate attention. So it creates a lot of animosity long-term, even if it accomplishes things short-term. So it's an asset. I mean, I have my luscious hair and sparkling personality that I could deploy at any time. But, you know, these are things that you have to use sparingly. And of course, there's narcissism, vanity, and ego. All of these things are off the chart these days with social media and everyone seeking attention. But because they exist and because people care, genuine flattery can get doors open. But disingenuous flattery can close those doors. I don't know how many emails I get from people who tell me, oh, I love your podcast, would love to be on, or they're representing someone who wants to be on the show. And it's so clear to me that they've never heard it. So why even say it? Because it turns me off completely. I'm like, I'm not even going to respond to these people. You have to show you've done your homework, because then the flattery actually means something. Give an example of something they said or did, or an opinion that they have that you want to dig deeper into. These are things that are the deepest form of flattery, because it shows you're listening. And that's all people want. They want to be heard. Another negative intangible is shame and fear. And I don't know when this happened exactly, but somehow society decided that shaming people online and getting them fired or canceled is a great way to rehabilitate them and fix the world. When in reality, all that does is create more animosity and creates an opposition that's equal to or possibly greater than the tool that's deployed. Now, it is still a powerful tool. We respond to shame and fear. Now, shame and fear work best as collective action. If you're trying to stop a company from using slave labor in some other market, or from polluting a river, or keeping Roseanne from mean tweets, things like that, important things. But it should be used sparingly, because the animosity it creates is as bad, if not worse, than the benefits from that tool, even though the benefits are personal, and then the toxicity and the fallout is socialized to everybody else. Another negative intangible is guilt. Now, guilt is related to shame, but it's turned inward. It's regulated by self-judgment as opposed to judgment by others. And what it does is it weaponizes your own insecurities or sense of privilege or immutable characteristics or lifestyle and makes you feel guilty enough to change or guilty enough to scream at others to get them to change. So it's a really devious tool that preys on our frailties. A lot of militant activism is the deployment of guilt. We switched over from Christian shame, things that are sinful in the Bible, sex or whatever, coveting something of your neighbors, to being shamed about your skin color, whether it was black or now white, or shamed about eating meat, or having kids before Greta can save the earth. These things are now sins of a secular kind. What's really interesting about it is this only works on the meek and unsuccessful. People who have a high self-worth will never respond to guilt narratives, but they will put it on as a disguise to endear themselves to their chosen tribe. And that's really them deploying it as a tool, exactly what we're talking about here, to get ahead, to get followers, to get into a position of power. That is the tool in operation, at work. But ultimately, guilt is a very weak power source. Long-term reciprocity has to be powered by value, because value perseveres where guilt withers away. Another negative intangible is coercion and fear. A great example of it is Mark Lohr, who was the founder of diapers.com, which later became Quibi. Allegedly, he was bullied and threatened into selling his business to Amazon because supposedly Jeff Bezos told him, hey, if you don't sell to us, we will crush you. We will undersell you at a loss. We can absorb those losses and you're going to fail. So he basically was forced to sell. And then Mark, motivated by this, went on to found Jet.com, which he eventually sold to Walmart, to try to defeat Amazon. He didn't end up succeeding, but it served as a motivation for him because he was coerced into something he didn't want to do. I've actually been surprised by how much fuel fear puts in the tank. If you look at what's happening now, we have doctors and academics who are afraid to speak out on basic scientific truths because they don't want to be canceled. So they're caving in to the woke mob, and so is their administration. So no one has their backs, and they essentially are lying because they're afraid for their jobs. So this environment of fear can get compliance. What I'm hopeful of is that, sort of like McCarthyism and other sort of moral panics, once people start speaking up, others who may have been more reluctant will start speaking out as well, and eventually the truth will win out. But I'm not as certain as I once was, because now there are a lot of giant corporations and powerful institutions that can very easily crush you and don't give a crap whether you ever make a living or not. So that is different than the environment of the 50s. And of course, the most common negative intangible is lying. There are harmless versions of it, the whole fake it till you make it. That could range from having a really fancy website that makes it look like you're a much bigger company than you were, or having offices in a place where it looks like you're more successful than you really are. But it starts to turn dark when you're lying about blood tests or actual financials of your company in order to get millions and millions of investment. So, you know, there's a spectrum here. Some lies could be harmless. You know, look, a lot of entrepreneurs are overly optimistic and they make promises that may or may not come true. But I think professional investors are good at discounting that when it applies to the future. But when you're applying it to the past and lying about stuff that actually happened but didn't, that's when you get into some serious problems. And the biggest problem with lying is that eventually catches up with you because most people aren't very good at keeping their story straight. And then people who you've spoken to over time start to speak to each other. And before you know it, all of the lies get uncovered and you destroy your reputation. And reputation these days is all that you've got because it's the ultimate intangible asset. The last two things I want to mention are localism and timing. Localism, really what I mean by that is specificity. How specific you are in terms of the groups that you're addressing, your cause or mission, what you want to accomplish, the geography you're dealing with. The more tightly you can draw those lines, the more successful you'll be because you're going to be a much more compelling magnet for the kinds of allies that you want because they'll want you as well because you're focusing on the very things that they're interested in. Another important thing here is timing. The bigger your ask, the more time you have to put in to accrediting yourself. If the world only had two people in it, one was a builder and the other was a farmer, and the farmer needed a new house, that farmer might have to provide a lot of carrots before the builder is motivated enough to build the house because the time and materials and complexity of that ask is much greater. So that's important to keep in mind whenever you're positioning yourself for someone and also breaking it down into bite-sized pieces that aren't as time and resource demanding will work in your favor. And ultimately, few relationships are one-to-one exchanges, especially when you're dealing with intangibles. These things unfold over time. But what they can't be is lopsided forever. So at some point, you have to start evening them out. And finally, it's also important to use this approach to take stock of your deeper relationships with friends, family, spouses, lovers, especially if you have both a spouse and a lover. Then you really have to work on your reciprocity. But seriously, you have to take that Marie Kondo moment. I don't know if you know who she is, but that's the woman who, the Japanese woman who tells you to look at all the objects that you own and simplify your life by asking, does this bring me joy? And if it doesn't, you throw it out. And you pretty much have to do the same thing with the relationships in your life, whether it's a loving relationship or a professional relationship. And if you find that it does bring you joy or it does bring you value, then you have to invest in it, especially if you're the one that's slacking. That's it for this episode. As you can tell, this is still a work in progress, but hopefully you found this interesting. The next edition in this series will talk about trust. I don't think you'll want to miss it. If you enjoyed this, you'll definitely enjoy that. That episode is about to go up on Patreon for subscribers only. So please subscribe, support the show, patreon.com/McFuture. And if you can't support financially, then please review it on iTunes and share it with others. Thanks so much. I'm Steve Factor. See you next time on The McFuture.